About the recent results we obtained. CREST is a cryogenic dark matter search, which is located in Gran Sasso National Laboratory. And it uses scintillating calcium tungstate crystals as a target. So here you see the type of crystals when they are illuminated with ultraviolet light. So they are 4 centimeters in diameter and 4 centimeters high and weigh about 300 grams each. And our experimental setup in its present stage can hold up to 33 of such detectors in a modular structure. And in my talk, I can make this very short because I guess I don't have to tell you about the direct detection challenge. You certainly know. And then I will discuss a bit more in detail the CREST detectors and the setup. And then the most part of my talk I will devote to results from the latest run. Okay. Okay, just very brief. This shows, I mean, the problem of, or the challenge of direct detection is, of course, the smallness of the nuclear recoil energy and the fact that it is a nuclear recoil. And what one has to detect is an energy spectrum which is not very characteristic. So it rises roughly exponentially at low energies, and it reaches up to only 40 kV, even for the highest wind masses in the case of calcium tungstate. So just to give you a feeling about the typical background rates, which we have to fight against, is that in, let's say, in an underground laboratory, well shielded, you still have something like order of 10,000 counts per kilogram a year of beta gamma counts background. And this is very hard to shield any better and to improve on that. So it's clear that one needs detectors which can efficiently discriminate this beta and gamma. Oh, great. Oh, perfect. Which can efficiently discriminate beta and gammas. And this is now almost all experiments have set to various degrees of efficiency. In our case, it's internal in the crystals. As almost all backgrounds is internal in the crystals. So the next important background is neutrons from alpha N reactions in the surrounding rock and spontaneous fission. And this is when not shielded. Yeah? No. Oh, the background does not depend on temperature. Why do you think it should? I mean, unless the detectors work properly, if they work properly, it shouldn't depend.
But in the internal ones, won't they depend on some level on the temperature of the crystals?
No.
It's
no, it doesn't. It's radioactivity.
Sorry.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so the neutron background, when not shielded, if you open the shield, you have in the order of 100 counts per kilogram in the year. So this means if you want to compare a rate which we have at least to aim for, it's clear one also needs a massive neutron moderator around the experiment where you slow down these neutrons such that they cannot make recoils energetic enough to disturb us.
Can I ask you this number of 100 recoils, is that single scatters or does it include multiple scatters?
This is roughly single scatters. So what?
Okay, so that's a dangerous.
I mean, let's say it can be. The order is, we have measured it long time ago. It's in the order of, one per kilogram and day. So it can be even a bit higher. So this is just to write down a straight number. It can be 300.
What's the ratio of single to multiple scatters?
No, it's about the same as with a source. It's in the order of, this depends mostly on the geometry of your detector. So it is, I mean, it's very little energy dependent. and you will have something like 3 singles for 1 coincident. This is the order of magnitude for our detector. And so then the smallest, there is another type of neutrons which come from high energetic muons which create neutrons, mostly in the lead copper sheet in our case. And this is in the order of 10 per kilogram in the year. And this is in the same order of what one is roughly aiming for. So this means we also need an efficient muon vector around the experiment. This is now something specific to CREST, since it has a crystal which contains 3 types of nuclei. This shows the counts which we will register as a function of wind mass above a threshold of, let's say, 12 kV. And what one sees at low energy, at low wind masses, it's only the oxygen recoils which make it above the threshold, of course. And then at a little bit higher wind, around 10 GeV wind mass, oxygen and calcium are equally important. And at higher wind masses, tungsten totally dominates due to this assumed A square scaling. So what we do is we consider all 3 types of nuclei to cover the largest possible range of wind masses. I will now shortly introduce the detectors. So as they consist of a crystal and a superconducting phase transition thermometer, which is in the case of the large crystal just a tungsten film. Come to that. And when an energy is deposited in this crystal, what we finally see is a temperature pulse of the sensor. There is some more or less complex physics in between, but the net result is a temperature pulse of the thermometer, which has a duration of a couple of 10 milliseconds. And how we read out this temperature changes is this film is a superconductor, which we stabilize somewhere in the middle of the superconducting to normal conducting transition. And then we get a small temperature rise, gives us a measurable resistance rise. So just to give you a feeling about the involved orders of magnitude, so the width of such a transition is typically in the order of a millikelvin, while KeV signals, this is what we want to measure, produce in the order of a microkelvin signals. And it's also, this thing doesn't have a constant slope. It changes as a function of the position. So this means we also need a long-term stability of microkelvin in order to guarantee a stable response over the time. Okay. I show you the trick how we achieve it. So each thermometer is equipped with a heater, which we can use for stabilizing and also for injecting heater pulses. And this shows heater pulses of various energies injected as a function of time. And you see the response is quite stable. And how we do it is we, let's say, assuming we are stabilizing here, we inject a heater pulse, a large one, which heats up to the normal conducting transition. And then the height of this pulse measures just the distance to the top. And this we keep constant by our feedback. And this gives us the stable response as a function of time. And what we also use is this pulses here. You see there are many narrowly spaced pulses here. And this we use to check the trigger efficiency as a function of energy, really to confirm that we trigger 100% efficient at the energy of interest. So in CREST-2, we combine, so this detector which you saw on the previous slide is now upside down. This is the big crystal with the tungsten sensor, which we can call from now on phonon channel, the signals of this sensor. And we combine it with a second detector of the same type, which is also a cryogenic calorimeter, which also has its own sensor. And these two detectors together are enclosed into a highly reflective shielding, which, and I will come back to this point, this is very important which also scintillates. And the phonon channel gives, this is the nice thing of this technique, the phonon channel gives a very precise measurement of the energy independent of the type of interaction. So we are not dependent on whether it's a nuclear recoil or a gamma. We always measure precisely the energy. And the light channel, the light signal helps to distinguish the interaction type because, for example, nuclear recoils give less scintillation light. Here you see this is a structure which is coming from betas and gammas. And if you add a neutron source, you see a second structure appearing, which are oxygen recoils. And they have a smaller slope and can be nicely distinguished. And it turns out that different nuclei, depending on the mass of the nucleus, have slightly different or have different light output. So at least to some extent, we can distinguish the different nuclei by their slope. Unfortunately, it's difficult to excite the other nuclei with neutrons, so you have to believe me in the moment. So this is how a detector looked like, or some, okay, how a detector looks like. This is the cylindrical calcium tungstate crystal with its thermometer, and you can, the heater structure is not visible. And this is a light detector, which is a sapphire wafer, which has a micrometer of silicon to absorb the light. And this looks like a sunglass, which is optimally tuned for 420 nanometers blue light. And you see here this tiny structure. This is then the thermometer for the light detector. Maybe I have to tell you the challenge really of this measurement is here with this thing we register keV energies. And a typical energy of scintillation light, which is detected by this one, is let's say in the order of 1 to 2%. So this means we have to register 10, 20 eV with the light detector. So this is really the challenge. The light detector is the critical issue or the critical element in this game. Let me now come to a specific background which can cause many problems, and we will come back to this several times. So there's lead 210, which is almost always present because it follows on the radon decay chain and it deposits on surfaces. And you typically find it on any surface. Yeah. So if this lead 210 sits on the crystal, we get the energy of the recoil nucleus and the alpha can go away. In this case, we get at least the energy of this recoil nucleus plus maybe a little bit of this alpha energy if it was implanted a little bit. So this means this is not a dangerous background because its energy will be 103 kV or more. The dangerous case can be when the lead 210, which then decays into finally into polonium, which makes an alpha decay and the lead 210 recoil nucleus. In this case, the recoil nucleus can be also, when this was a little bit implanted, can lose some of its energy. So it can deposit an energy which is below 103 kV or even in the range of interest. And since this lead is so heavy, it gives very little light, similar to tungsten, and we cannot distinguish. So this is a very dangerous background. And there's one way against it. If we cover this surface with a scintillator, then this alpha would give a scintillation light, which then adds to the scintillation of light of this recoil nucleus, and the event is no longer in the nuclear recoil band. So whenever you can, you manage to completely cover all interior surface of your module with scintillator, this is no longer a dangerous background. And we have one exception to it, and these are the clamps which hold the crystals. I mean, this is not because we are stupid, but the reason is we had when we had tried this in a previous run, when you cover these clamps with scintillator, the crystal gets in contact with plastic. And in plastic, you have always randomly occurring relaxation processes once it's cold. And this can take a long time, for half a year or a year. And this gives you then some energy deposits in the crystal, which usually you see because the time structure of the signal is different. But once the signals are very, very small, it can well be that you mix them up and you cannot really clearly, you cannot guarantee that you separate them with 100% efficiency. Therefore, we voted in this run to not cover these clamps with scintillator. And this we had to pay with a very high background, as you will see. Let me come back now to the performance of the phonon channel at low energy, how well it can measure energy. Here you see just the energy spectrum of one phonon channel. It can resolve energies down to 3.6 keV of calcium-41, for example. And we find this line at very much the expected nominal position. The same applies for the copper X-ray peak and also for the lead 210 inside the crystal. You see this looks a little bit strange with a broad right shoulder. This is due to the fact that the beta decay populates the transition, the gamma transition, but this happens very quickly. So the detector adds the two decay energies. So you see the beta spectrum on top of the gamma line. And we find the left shoulder exactly where we expect them. So in summary, we can say we have a very precise and stable energy measurement over time. And we have, in the phonon channels, we can measure energies with resolutions in the order of 300 eV, stable over the whole period. And this, just as an example, at the same time, you can measure with this detector also at very high energies. It's not a separate run. It's just the data looked at high energies. And you see a number of alpha emitters embedded in the crystal, which in this case then give discrete lines. And something which you see here is this tungsten 180. This was in the past thought to be stable, but we found it decays with 10 to the 18 years of half-life.
So there is no lead 210 inside the crystal itself?
Yes, it is.
There is?
Polonium. Okay, now I understand. This lead 210 makes many features. You can have this feature. This is a gamma plus an edit. But then you have it decays to bismuth and then to polonium. And from the polonium, you get this here, which is labeled here polonium intern. This is this line. And then you get even a polonium extern when the activity sits on the surface or external. Then the nuclear recoil energy is missing. Therefore, we know that this polonium, there is a certain fraction of the polonium sitting on the surface. So did this answer your question? So. Okay, this is the setup which we are using. In yellow, this is the neutral moderator, which is just 45 centimeters of polyethylene or something like 15 tons. And inside, we have a muon veto, which consists of 20 plastic scintillator panels. And inside the muon veto, there is the lead and the copper shielding. And this, again, is enclosed in a radon box to prevent the radon from penetrating inside the shielding. And inside that box, there is vacuum. This is where the detectors are mounted. And the cold temperature is generated up here, and it's transferred with this long copper rod, 1.5 meter copper rod, in the region to the detectors. Okay, so let me now come to the results of our latest run. So it was from June 2009 to April 2011. And there were a couple of gamma calibrations and two neutron tests. And in total, we had 18 modules installed. And only, and this is the ugly thing, only 10 complete modules were operational in that sense, that mostly the light detector didn't reach the transition temperature. We usually vote for very low transition temperatures because this gives best sensitivity, but for some reasons we couldn't cool enough, so only 10 reached, light detectors reached the transition. And it turned out one of them was a think tank cell module, which I don't want to discuss more in a moment. And so we are left with 9 calcium tungstate, and out of them, one was performing in such a way that it wouldn't be able to really see too many of the WIMPs, so we excluded it also. So we are finally left with 8 modules. But we use all the other modules, the 10 complete and the 7 individual ones, to tag coincidences. So incomplete means these are modules which register energy but can't distinguish nuclear recoils from gammas. Okay, now I come to the point how we define the nuclear acceptance band. The first step is, this is the gamma band which is recorded during a run. And what we do is we fit this gamma band, the center and the width as a, yeah? So this is the whole data set, so this is, yeah, 1.5 years or so. A whole data set. I don't have it with me, but what would be interesting, of course, is the time series of the events which are then in the nuclear acceptance region. And this is but they are very, sorry, you should have asked earlier than I had prepared it, but they are very flat, I would say. I mean, there are periods where there's an earthquake or so, where the detector stops for half an hour or something like that, or whether there are periods where there's a short construction work going on and you have some bursts. But this is what we remove in the analysis, and what we are finally left with has a Poissonian time distribution. Okay, let me come back. So what we fit is the centroid and the width as a function of energy. And then this gives us the light detector resolution as a function of the detected light energy. And then we apply the quenching factor to the center. So this gives us then the light resolution at the quenched energy. And this is, for example, this is when we apply this procedure to a neutron test. So this is not a fit. We just take this thing, apply the quenching factor, and end up with a nuclear recoil acceptance band, which nicely encloses the neutrons. Okay, let me now come to the observed events. So what we see in all detectors, as I said before, an very highly populated gamma band. And there are alpha events, which I will say, which come from alpha emitters embedded in the clamps. And there is also a structure which is visible in almost all detectors, which is due to this lead-206 recoil nuclei. And then there are some events in low energies in the region where we expect WIMP-induced nuclear recoils. Yeah. Now, what you see is
well,
I can.
Why is it
So, for example, these bands are typically 10 times more populated, 10 to 20 times more populated than the rest. So you have so in a short, yeah, I can maybe if I come back to my at the end, I can show you this was also used for testing the Gaussianity of the distribution, because here you have enormous amounts of events in, and then you can plot the Gaussian profile, and you have measured it with 10 times more statistics than in the region of interest, and you can sort of say from that conclude that it's reasonable. Okay, so how we proceed then is we define some acceptance region. The upper energy limit is 40 keV, and this is chosen because there is almost, there is no significant WIMP signal expected above. And the lower limit is chosen such that we have a well-defined gamma leakage of one expected event per module in the whole data set. Okay, if we do that and count events in all modules, we end up with 700, we end up with 67 events in all detectors in the whole data set. Okay, so now the a little bit boring part starts. We have to discuss this background. First, I mean, these events in the acceptance region can be various types of backgrounds, like leakage, what I already mentioned, leakage of electron gamma events, or it can be alpha events because alpha bands overlap with the acceptance band. It can be neutron background, and it can be also led to 6 recoil events. If they are low energetic enough, they can leak into the signal region. And if this would all not be enough, we can think about some possible WIMP signal. So the aim of the analysis is that we estimate these backgrounds and determine whether there is some room left for a possible WIMP signal. And this we do via likelihood analysis. So in this talk, I will give a qualitative background estimate which to illustrate the principle which enters this likelihood analysis. And in this likelihood analysis, which produces the final results, we consider the full information of the events in the energy light plane. So we do a two-dimensional fit. And we account, as I said, also for a possible WIMP contribution. And we take, and this procedure allows to take into account uncertainties of all relevant parameters like quenching factors and things like that. And this is not clear in the moment, but I will make it clear. We will also include information from reference measurements in other regions of this energy light plane or in separate measurements. So let me come to this alpha background. Here you can see the nature of, you can see this alpha background. These are the internal lines in the crystal. And you can see there is a continuous structure going down to low energies. And these are from alphas, emitters which are embedded in the volume of the clamps. And they suffer energy losses so that you have alphas escaping with basically with zero energies.
So this is from simulation?
Sorry?
The alpha background is from simulation.
No, there's a measurement. No, it's a measurement. It's just more or less, you see there are other structures which, okay, this is a scene looked at the data just in a wider energy range. Normally we show the data only up to here. And if you can also look in a wider energy range and then you see this structure.
So it looks like there's some structure slightly higher, like, you know,
yeah. This is which you normally don't see in our data, and I can say why. So this is all such vetoed led to 6 recoils. So when this happens, when an alpha hits the external scintillator, the scintillating foil, and the led to 6 recoil goes to the crystal, so this is roughly at 100 keV. And you add some scintillation light of the foil, therefore you are out of the nuclear recoil band. And you see there is some structure pulling up, And these are alpha events which are in the crystal a little bit subsurface. So you get some additional energy from the alphas before they get out of the crystal. And they have roughly a similar slope than this structure. And normally we cut these things away because the scintillation of this foil produces a fast scintillation light. So we can look to the time structure of the light pulses and we can recognize whether it's a normal event or this. So this is mostly raw data. Otherwise, normally we remove this because it clears the picture.
So why is the slope actually not the same? Because it's both alphas, so you would expect the same quenching factor for alphas.
Yeah, okay, it's a bit difficult. You see, if you are very optimistic, you might see two different types. And the reason is we have also two different types. The foil is one type of scintillator, and then we have some rings, scintillator rings, which clamp the foil. This is a more efficient scintillator. So you could imagine that you can have a mixed scenario of different amount of scintillation light. But what is important for us is only that it's more, that it comes out of the nuclear recoil band. Okay, let me now discuss the estimation of the alpha background. As you see, we have here these counts in the alpha band, we have this overlap, and it's clear some of these events can be alpha background. And how we proceed is we define a reference region where the alpha band doesn't overlap with another band and count the alpha events in that region. And if we can assume that the spectral energy density is flat, from the counting we can simply determine the density. And this we do for all detectors, and we end up with something like 93 in all detectors, and then we can compute from the overlap how many of them we expect in the signal region, and this gives us something like 9 events.
So and if you abandon the assumption of a flat distribution,
comes here. In the likelihood analysis, we abandon this. We allow a linear energy dependent term to enter to get this additional freedom. But it turns out that this alpha estimate is rather robust, and the likelihood fit gives very much the same result.
You could, of course, imagine it higher.
I mean, of course, we have simulated how alphas escape from, if you have various distributions in the volume, how the spectrum, usually it gives actually a slightly falling spectrum towards low energies. You don't get something which piles up. Okay, so let me come to the estimation of the neutron background. So neutrons, of course, can produce oxygen recoils as very much like light WIMPs do. The only difference is that they may cause coincidences in several detector elements. And we have hints that there are some neutrons present, because in the data set we have, besides the 67 events, we find 3 coincident events with a recoil in the acceptance region where other detectors trigger at the same time. So we have 2 events where in total 3 detectors trigger, and 1 event where 5 detectors triggered. And the idea is now we could use this coincidences to estimate the background. So the idea is to calibrate the single to coincident ratio with suitable neutron sources, and then use this calibrated ratio and the measured number to give a rough estimate of the neutron background. Yeah?
What is the neutron source?
Here?
For the calibration, the single coincidence.
For the calibration, we use, okay. So we do, let me, I come to that point. So we consider two types of neutron background. One is neutrons from radioactive processes inside the neutron shielding. And this the most, or the thing which could cause it is spontaneous fission in the lead copper shield, and also very remotely it can be some alpha N reactions in copper, because there are a few alpha emitters which are above 7 MeV, which is the threshold for neutron emission in copper. So as I said, this can be studied with a neutron source, and what we used is an americium beryllium source, and we placed this source outside the lead copper shielding. You remember there's this, in some places it's even 50 centimeters thick. And what you do is, if you put a neutron source there, it almost doesn't matter which source you put, because inside this lead copper moderates these neutrons to a uniform spectrum, which almost doesn't depend on what you put outside.
So can you use that sort of method for general neutron calibration?
Yes, so we check this, of course, but I will come to that point. We check this, of course, you measure the same ratio. If you put the neutron source inside where you have high energetic neutrons, you measure slightly higher, more coincident ones, but I can show you the picture, is almost no difference.
No, so, what I meant, so when you calibrate the regions of the neutron scatterer,
yeah,
you use that by calibrating against the neutron source, right?
Yeah.
To figure out what is the quenching factor.
Yes.
But that is usually done by shooting mono-energetic neutrons on the...
No. In this case, since we see it, we shoot just with a broad energy spectrum, and you get, as you saw this, okay, maybe I go back. I hope we find it again. Anna? Sorry. Here you see it doesn't matter, because it's the slope of the structure which is the quenching factor. So you don't need... No, this is a neutron source. This was created by putting a neutron source outside the lead copper shielding. This gives you neutrons of a typical energy of, let's say, 500 kV, and they make neutron oxygen recoils up to 300 kV. 300 kV. So I hope I find it again.
The reason I'm asking this is important, because there was this criticism in the literature by Ralston that all the calibration done with neutrons are wrong because they're using a monochromatic.
Well, this is Ralston arguments you have to discuss in details. Most of these arguments, in my opinion, are wrong.
but this is case where it's really wrong.
Yeah. Okay, so, and the second type of neutrons we consider is muons induced by, muon-induced neutrons, most of them come from the lead copper shielding, and so this could be muons which are missed by the veto and nevertheless hit the lead copper shielding, and it can be neutrons from muons interacting in the rock where the muon doesn't hit the veto and the shielding, yeah? And this can be studied with muon coincident events, or with events coincident with the muon veto, to be more precise. So here is the result. This is what we obtain when we put the neutron source, the americium beryllium source. We measure the coincidences are mostly double coincidences, or a few triple, very few triple, and almost no higher order coincidences. And we get a single to coincident ratio of something like 3.8. And if we multiply this by 3, we get something a bit more than 10 or 11 singles expected from 3 observed coincidences. And this would be the case for the muon-induced neutrons. We have many higher multiplicity coincidences. And the reason is very simple, because the muons, I mean, in this case, a neutron goes from one detector to the other. And this is the nature of the coincidences. And in this case, it's that several or many neutrons at the same time hit the detectors. And therefore, you have much higher multiplicities.
So could one actually extrapolate to Dharma? So I mean, if you, from those pictures, it looks like that the internal relativity is much more dangerous, because it tends to produce single hits, whereas muon-induced neutrons induce multiple hits. So if you don't have the muon meter, then the left background is probably the dangerous
one. Yeah, it's more dangerous. Yeah, but when one has this, okay. But Dharma doesn't, it's different story. Yeah, another experiment. So to proceed is from this ratio, one would only estimate 1.5 singles. So of course, in reality, we can have both backgrounds, and this could be considered as some limiting cases. And what we actually do, one other point I have to mention, that the measured recoil energy spectra of both sources within statistics agree. This is at first glance a bit surprising, because this muon-induced neutrons are usually high energetic. But as I said before, this massive lead copper thing more or less brings all the neutrons to the same uniform spectrum, independent on what the primary source is. Okay, in this likelihood analysis, what we do is we use these measured coincidences of the calibration runs, so to say, and the measured coincidences of the three observed events to decide what type is really there. So we let it decide, the fit decides it. So it can, both types are there, but it decides which mixture. And, I said we use these multiplicities, we include the spectral information, and again, not too surprising is that the final result is between these two limiting cases, as you will see. So now I have to speed up a little bit with all these backgrounds. So this is a detector which has the worst recoil background. You can see, since it has so many events, you can see that it really can tail down to the region of interest. And we have to account for a possible leakage. This is clear. So how we proceed is very similar to the alpha estimate. We define a region in the tail of this distribution where we expect lead recoils. And then we sum all those recoils in all detectors. And then we fit the tail of this distribution with an exponential centered at 90 keV with some constant, with some offset and a scale factor. Why we don't include the full energy deposition peak into the fit is because this can have two different origins, because this lead to 10 on the crystal also contribute, but this cannot contribute in the tail. Therefore, we fit only the tail. And if we use then this fit to extrapolate into the acceptance region, we estimate something like 17 events leaking. And what we do differently in the likelihood analysis, we account for some slight variations of overlap between signal and lead band. And we do the treatment module wise. And the result?
Can you put an error on this 7?
Yes, we will have an error on all of these things. I mean, this is just, I thought if I simply say we did a fit, you won't believe anything. So I say a little bit what goes into it, that you can develop your own feeling what might be behind. We can give, of course, errors on all of these things. So, I mean, the question is, of course, whether this extrapolation is is legitimate, so whether one can do it, or how this background, what is how it behaves below in the extrapolation region. And to study this, we have made some SRIM simulation. SRIM stands for stopping in range of ions in matters. This is a package which you can use for calculating the transport of ions in any material. And we calculated the energy of ejected lead 206 recoils. And for two let's here shown for two different distributions. The green one assumes that, let's say, this radon deposits on the surface, and then you have two subsequent alpha decays which implant then the nuclei. And when the polonium then decays its subsurface, and this would give this distribution, this green one, which doesn't look very much like what we measure. But if you assume a thin surface layer, this looks very much like what we measure. And we do the same procedure. We fit here, and we extrapolate here. And we see the extrapolation describes very much the data there. And this we take at least as some kind of justification that this is the right procedure to use. And here we study, I mean, 3 nanometers is a very special assumption. But this is to show you that it doesn't depend very much on what thickness you assume. And unless it's a thin layer, more or less, the simulations always give you the same result. OK, let me now come to the likelihood analysis, but very, very briefly, I only mentioned the basic ingredients. So what we do is we formulate each source of events via a density function, which is in the energy coordinate just the spectral energy density. And in the Lighted coordinate, it's a Gaussian distribution, which is given by the respective quenching factor and the respective resolution. And for all the various backgrounds, we have each background contributes a term, and they sum up and give the total expectation. And let's say if we want to compute the total number of events which we saw or which we expect to see, we integrate this density over the energy and the light yield coordinate in sum over the detector modules to get the total observed. And the nice thing is we can use directly these density functions even if they are not normalized in this extended likelihood formalism. The normalization is kind of restored by this exponential factor. And the nice thing is that we don't have to bin the data. We have just to take the product over the events in one detector, over all events in one detector, and then the outer product runs over the detectors. Okay. So almost through. And then we have these reference measurements, and like this alpha measurement in the alpha reference region or the lead measurement in the lead reference region. This each contributes a term which has about the same structure. Then there is this multiplicity term which has a little bit different structure, but it also multiplies to, and the product then gives us the total likelihood, which we then maximize, and this gives us the best estimate for signal and background parameters. And we use a likelihood ratio test to estimate the significance of a signal. And this is the likelihood ratio with the cross section fixed at 0, so the WIMP contribution forced to 0, all other parameters fitted divided by the overall likelihood of the overall best fit. And this ratio is a measure of how signal-like the observation is. And more specifically, we can use this Wilks theorem, which is strictly valid only for large statistics, and can directly use this quantity Q to compute the significance. So, but one has to say that this Wilks theorem is only valid for large statistics, so this has to be checked, and this is what we did with a Monte Carlo, that it still applies for the kind of statistics you are using, and it does. Okay, this gives the results of the various of the likelihood fit, and the surprising thing is that we get two solutions. This was very unexpected in the first moment. And these solutions mostly differ by the mass of the rim. So in one case, it's heavier than in the other case. And all background parameters are, of course, different, but rather similar for both solutions. And about roughly one-third is explained as signal in this case. And the reason for these two solutions is very simple to understand. You can use two different compositions of this recoil spectra to compose a spectrum which has very much the same shape. So as you see, this is the overall fit function for the two maxima. This is basically the same. And the rim spectrum itself is only slightly different. And the difference is that this large mass solution contains or consists mostly of tungsten recoils and calcium recoils and some only very few oxygen, while the light mass solution consists of about half-half oxygen calcium.
So at least the distribution in the light should tell you whether you have...
Yeah, the point is this degeneracy is gone once you have a better detector which has a perfect measurement of the non-overlapping measurement of the nuclear recoils, then this degeneracy would be gone. This is a consequence of the non-perfect, or let's say it in other words, the yield measurement could distinguish between these two solutions. But with our given resolution, both solutions are possible, and we cannot really distinguish.
But do you at least have an estimate? What is the fraction of the event? I mean, what is the fraction expected in oxygen, and what is the fraction in oxygen? I mean, what is really the distribution?
Yeah, this is what is written there.
Okay, this is the model, but I mean the data itself. Do you have an estimate of?
No, I think without these bands those bands are overlapping heavily. So
I think what Joseph is maybe saying it a little differently. Are the events mostly lying towards the tungsten band, or are the events mostly lying towards the...
So it comes with the next one. Okay, I'm shortly in a second come to the yield distribution. So here you see the backgrounds just for one solution. I want to discuss the energy dependence of the various contributions. You see, this again is the total fit function, and this strange zigzagging comes because each detector has a different energy threshold, and whenever it sets in, you have a sharply rising expectation. And in green, you see the expected WIM contribution, in red, this is gamma leakage, and all the other backgrounds are kind of flat compared to the other ones. So the shape of the alpha, neutron, and lead backgrounds differs from a WIM signal, and they do not rise towards low energies, at least not significantly.
That's really your assumption, right? That went into the fit.
No, it's not an assumption. You put in the measured yield the measured energy spectrum of the neutrons of, you put...
I mean, for the neutron, from the neutrons, it's from beta, but for, say, the alphas, you're measuring in another region, and if it had a low energy rise, like the gamma background, that wouldn't show up in the fit, right? Because...
Okay, let's say if the alpha region would be flat from 40, so we can observe it, it's flat from 40 kV to 2 MeV.
Right,
if it would suddenly rise below... from 40 to 12 kV, then we couldn't see it. Yeah.
Right.
So I have this clear. If there is
to me, the argument that you assume that the you assume the distribution is flat because it's flat up above, and then you reject that as an explanation of the excess because it's flat up above. So
yeah, okay, let's say it come to this point when I discuss the yield.
Right.
The yield distribution forbids this possibility,
okay.
I would say. Okay, let's take it. I hope I come back to your argument. So it's only the gamma leakage which looks kind of like the swim contribution and of course could explain the observation if we determine it for some reason too small. If in reality it's bigger, it might do it in terms of the energy spectrum. But this looks, this is now the yield distribution. It looks a little bit strange because it's a projection of this acceptance region which widens towards low energies to the yield axis. And what we see is here is the total, the lead, the WIMP, the alphas, and the gamma leakage. And what you see is that there is not much more room to increase the gamma leakage too much. So the gamma leakage is clear, it comes from above, it's at high yields. So there is not, the data wouldn't allow it to increase too much.
Where's the M2 curve? Is there an M2 curve on that or not? For the WIMP signal?
No, unfortunately,
okay.
Okay, in the paper we have an
that's
M2 right. Because it's already busy enough. I saw the take one. But the picture is the same, roughly. And also you see the alphas. I mean, of course, there is some room to increase it, but not, maybe it's maybe difficult to increase it too much more. Of course, these arguments are not 100% solid, but I would say from the yield distribution, it says that there's not much room to increase high light yield contributions significantly. So let me come to the significance to make it short. So we use this likelihood ratio test as explained, and then we get for these two solutions two significances if you force the signal to zero. And from these enormous numbers, it's clear that from a statistical point of view, the considered background sources alone are not sufficient to explain the data. And it's clear that some additional source of events is needed, and WIMPs would do it because they rise at low energies and they would have suitable properties. But at that point, here one has to be rather careful, and we have to say that the backgrounds are still relatively large. And I think for an ultimate clarification of the situation, we have to reduce the systematic uncertainties in modeling of these backgrounds. So in other words, we have to get rid of most of these backgrounds and see whether the situation still remains as we see it now. And then I think our belief is strongly enforced. So this is what, if we look for the confidence contours, so these are these two solutions. M1 and M2. And of course, both solutions seem to be largely excluded by many experiments. So these are these two possible solutions of the Dharma experiment, and this is coaching. And I mean, let's say it like this. When you look to such plots, this looks, of course, tremendous. It's many, many orders of magnitude. But when one looks at such plots, one has to always say, understand, in this coordinate, this is background. Yeah, this coordinate is energy threshold. So once you, the uncertainties of energy threshold map into these curves. And I mean, this is probably the reasons why one still considers such things, even if it seems to be largely excluded. Okay, one also can say all these things are calculated for a standard WIMP velocity distribution coming from an isothermal sphere. And of course, deviations from that will have different influences on different experiments. But this is, I mean, you can, it's difficult to discuss such things. So in summary, let me come to the conclusions. We had a long run. We found 67 events. And the observed events are difficult to explain with known backgrounds, at least the way how we model them. And we need some additional source of signals, either some unknown background, which we have not yet understood, I mean, or it could be WIMPs, they would have the right property to rise at low energies. So, but I repeat the sentence, the background is still relatively large, and for a final clarification, a reduction is necessary to reduce possible uncertainties in the modeling of these backgrounds. And we are preparing a new run where we think we are able to reduce this background really in a very relevant way. We have identified these clamps as the source of the background. I didn't talk about why and how this happened, but we are, I would say, sure that the background comes from them. And so we produced clamps. We made a new alloy for the clamps. And they will have a substantially lower alpha background. And we will cover these clamps only apart from the small area where it touches the crystal. They will receive a different construction. We will cover with scintillators, so we should be able to veto most of these lead 206 recoils. So in summary, we expect a substantial reduction, or zero alphas, and a substantial reduction of lead 206 recoils. And once we understood that this neutron spectrum is very low energetic inside the shielding, we also understood that some very thin and clean polyethylene inside could help a lot to further reduce any possible neutron background. 5 centimeters would roughly give a factor of 20 reduction. So this is what we want to do. And last but not least, we will replace the light detectors which had a too low transition by a transition which should be reachable. So, thank you.
Question? Ultimately, is there some reason, explanation for why you receive words compared to Xenon 100.
So you think there is the biggest contradiction to Xenon 100? Yes, of course.
Apparently,
yes. Yeah, there it is. Yeah, sure.
Why?
Yeah, as I said, I mean there are. Okay, it's another experiment. I cannot comment on this experiment. I can just say, you can move the low energy side of this exclusion curves quite a bit if you have an incomplete knowledge of your effective threshold. I can only say we measure our threshold very precisely. We monitor it all the time that we have 100% efficiency at the relevant region of interest, and we have a very precise calibration. The difference is there is no quenching factor in between. In all other experiments, like xenon, for example, or there is a quenching factor. You have to know this quenching factor in order to translate the measured light or the measured ionization to a given energy. And uncertain, and this quenching factor tends to be difficult to be measured and resist precise measurement very much. So there could be an uncertainty. I don't want to comment or say this is it. I just say there can be a problem.
So when they go to one ton xenon, they go to 1 times 0, would that make a difference for future xenons?
Yeah, the xenon makes it bigger. So let's say it, okay. Okay, I'm not an expert in xenon, but I can say if you watch the steps from xenon 10 to xenon 100, they achieved a very impressive background reduction in terms of the background which they had to measure. So the need of, they could get along with a reduced discrimination efficiency. They have something like, I think, less than 1% now. So this means if they get bigger, they have to increase, either decrease their background further or increase the discrimination efficiency, which is not very likely to happen because it decreased from 10, xenon 10 to xenon 100, because things get bigger and you don't achieve full coverage. So, I mean, each experiment has its own challenge to really go in the direction of making it bigger. And one can only answer once the experiment is there and is taking data whether this was successful. But the challenge is really to keep up the discrimination level, or, I mean, anything, any one of the two has to be improved. If you go from 100 to a ton, you have to improve one of the two by a factor of 10. Otherwise, you, I mean, they are now background limited. If you just increase the mass, it doesn't help. Yeah.
So looking into the future, can we go back to one of the blocks where you showed the distribution of events, especially the one where you can see the entire tail in the tungsten band?
Mm-hmm. This one.
Sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the thing that I would be worried about the most is the lead contamination somehow spreading over the energies and then really accumulating at low energies, which there seems to be some indications that there is accumulation at low energies. Now, I agree that you modeled it and you seem to see that there
is flat. And
I agree.
I mean,
but
of course.
But considering how important this thing is, right, you want to claim the detection of dark.
We have no proof, yeah.
Is there a way to experimentally probe that region?
I mean, strictly what I said is to, I mean, I personally would only, I mean, this background has to be removed. This is clear. If it's not there, you don't have to model it, and the uncertainty is gone.
No, but I'll be worried that what you're really saying is just the tail of that lead, you know, it's the alpha escaping and the lead coming in. But you're actually seeing it at lower energies. So
yes.
I could imagine this thing going like that, and then being very flat here, which is what you modeled,
yeah.
But somehow rising at low energies, right?
Yeah, but this is, I mean, okay, it's modeling, nothing else, yeah. But this is what I tried to show. This is what you saw as the green region, and this was the extrapolation.
But you agree that this is important enough that to answer with a simulation is somewhat unsatisfactory.
Yeah, but
yeah,
it's
great.
I
just want to answer it by decreasing the total rate by a factor of 10 and seeing if the signal goes down by a factor of
10. So, that's one way of doing it, but is that what will happen with the new synthet, with the new plants?
Let's say, like this, if you take away, you can play a game to take away that region where lead recoils are expected from the acceptance region. This, of course, removes most of the signals. Or not most, it removes a fraction of the signal, something, the event number goes down from 67 to 37 or so, and you will reduce the significance from 4 point whatever to 2.3 or 2.5. If you remove the region where you can see lead, so this drops significance by a factor of 2.
And which of the regions you are left with, M1 or M2?
Both drops by the same factor, yeah. Which is amazing, but this is, I mean, this was one of the questions we were asked by the referee.
So the question.
Are you saying anything
like annual modulation?
No, but annual modulation, let's say if you see the expected number of events, 24.
I mean, you can divide, you can do a two-way analysis.
Like, yes.
Come on, take the square root n of 30.
Yeah, we were discouraged by the
yeah,
the number.
Yeah, that's curious. It's one thing is much larger than the other. If you separate the two.
No, actually, we haven't done it really, because I think the prospect of being successful was low enough not to try it.
But it's easy for you.
No, but I mean, obviously, if you look at it, you see nothing. It's clear. So if you plot it as a function of time, you see nothing. Probably you would have to measure, with that statistics, you would have to measure 100 years to be able to see if there is something. I mean, the number is just, I would say, it would need...
Because in some very crazy models, because
yeah.
the modulation curve is very interesting. You can see something like a lot of number of events in the summer and
okay, maybe we should simply show this the occurrence of these events as a function of time.
Yeah. But then you looked at the distribution as a function
of course
time.
We look at
the
distribution.
Right away.
I mean, as I said, it's no obvious thing that you see there is a sine wave superimposed. It's clear, it cannot be.
Slightly off topic, but would this dry element sort of composition help in if you, say, try to detect between elastic scattering from, say, Stoker unionism and some enormous spectrum exactly, and it's sort of peaks at
I have to think about this.
You have different species. And it might be that you need to go to a much higher mass. Say you have a source of stop binds millions, right?
Yeah.
Not too far. I don't know what the location would be.
I mean, usually.
The fact that you have three targets doesn't help.
It doesn't help, and I guess the detector is probably too small. This would be my feeling, as neutrino detectors are usually. As you think by neutral current?
Yeah, yeah.
Detection,
yeah. You still have C squared.
Yes, of course.
N squared.
No, I would say in this case, probably the only thing we'll get. Okay, I haven't really thought about it, but we'll get enough energy transfer is probably the oxygen, I would assume. The heavier ones are just ballast because you don't have I guess you don't transfer enough energy.
From the muon source, you have up to 15
muon. Yes, but then you have to ask yourself, okay, it's true. Yeah, it's the same thing that the loss of coherence, which is given by the size of the nucleus, which is the same as with the dark matter. Yeah. So this cutoff at 40 keV is roughly due to the form factor. Now, to be honest, I haven't thought about it, whether this could help, because we were not offered such a source.
I think that's a good topic for the discussion, so let's thank Franz again.